I travelled home from a wedding or whatever with my wife. She was saying, I just don't know if I preferred you drinking or sober. That's what she said to me.
It's quite tough to hear.
And it spun me out completely. And I remember I talked to my sponsor about this, and he said to me, Kevin, whatever we put in front of our sobriety will get taken away from us anyway.
Mm.
And he was right, because I drank. And within 21 months, I was living in an Airbnb with my dog in a flat, and it was over. I still believe that this happens a lot in sobriety. When people get sober, this is a different person now. I'm a different person. The toxic guy that she fell in love with isn't there anymore. He's gone. He's still a bit toxic, especially in his sense of humour.
Only sometimes.
But he doesn't disappear, and he isn't a liar, and he isn't, you know what I mean? He's a different guy. My circuit board is completely new.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Kevin Bishop is a comic actor with a career spanning 3 decades. From Grange Hill via Muppet Treasure Island, The Kevin Bishop Show, and when he played Fletch in Porridge. Kevin's been in recovery for 13 years. He had 6 years, had a relapse for a year, and delightfully is 6 years back, sober and strong and very well. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Kevin, mate, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming. I know you're super busy, so I appreciate your time.
It's really nice to be here, Paul. Thank you for asking me on the show.
I'm very grateful. When we spoke, you said about where we first met in Hollywood, right? Paul McKenna's house on a Sunday.
Lovely Paul McKenna. Great. Really great. Really great guy. A very funny guy. Lovely guy. A good friend of mine. Used to go to his house a lot, and he said to me, Kevin, you are a really, really hilarious guy. It's really great to have you here. Meet Paul. And
that is literally exactly him.
I love Paul. He's just the loveliest, loveliest guy. And I remember it was back in those days, the first time I met you, I was still drinking.
Is that around 06-ish? 05,
yeah,
06?
Yeah, around 06. Yeah, it must have been, maybe it was a little bit, maybe it might have been 07 or something, I'm not sure, but it was definitely around that time.
Possibly.
And I was in Los Angeles. I think I was, what I normally used to do, we'd go over there trying to hustle down a job in America. Yeah. And it's changed now. It's not really, doesn't really have that feel anymore. You kind of work from whatever country you live in now. It's not essential to be there like it was then. And I remember I was at Paul's house, his lovely house. When,
the Rolling Stones actually made an album here. They made an album here, and that's, you can see, this is where the Rolling Stones made an album. And
so you got the tour as well.
Yeah, good tour. Great tour. Really, really great. And lovely Paul was there at his house, and he used to have these brilliant parties where there would be kind of a mix of everybody. There'd be all sorts turning up.
It was kind of the British.
All British.
One or two Americans, but mostly British, I think.
Well, there would be the Americans who subsequently there'd be cool Americans, because that was the place where all the Brits went.
Yeah.
So, and I remember that time was a real, there was a real Brit invasion going on. And so I was taken to Paul McKenna's house by Sadie.
Yeah.
Turner, who's our mutual friend. And I remember you were with Sadie, and Sadie came up to me, she went, Kev, I can't believe it. She went, I haven't had a drink for nearly 5 months. And I was like, why? And she went, well, I've stopped drinking. I was an alcoholic. And I went, were you? I had no idea. And she went, yeah. And I remember thinking in that moment, if she's stopped, what does that make me? Because I was just at it nonstop. Yeah. And whenever I went to Los Angeles, it made me very nervous, because it's a very professional place. And I was a very unprofessional drinker. Well, I was a professional drinker, but behaved very unprofessionally.
Yeah.
And I was very aware of how I could blow it out there. And if I did, I wouldn't come back. So I was always anxious about drinking in America. And I was, you know, spectacularly drinking
in America.
Was
you drinking that day?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I didn't see any, like, craziness going on.
No, but that was early. It was early. That was early in the evening.
I do remember something about that day, right? There was an American girl there, very pretty. Worked at an aesthetic clinic. Yeah, probably. Well, not when I tell you the story. But she worked in an aesthetic clinic. And she's like, oh, hi, how are you? What are you doing? She's having a chat and stuff. And I said to her, you're very pretty. She goes, yeah, I work at, like, you know, I've got a good surgeon I work with and stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, what kind of thing have you had done? She goes, well, I had my boobs done first. And then she goes, do you want to see them? I was like, yeah, sure, absolutely. So she showed me the boobs. I was very impressed. I was like, good surgeon. And then she said, I just had my butthole bleached as well. It's the first time I've heard that. I was like, okay. She said, do you want to see that as well? I was like, yeah, sure. Never seen it before, seen it now. But it was very weird. It was a very weird thing to introduce yourself as. So I remember that.
And that was in the driveway. So
that's before I got in the house, yeah. She had the clipboard of names just to let you go in.
Oh, great, you've met. Paul was there at the house and doing what he does. He's a great host. And you and Sadie were there. And I remember you standing there with Sadie. And she said, Kev, this is my friend Paul. And I said, oh, right. And she said, Paul doesn't drink either. And I remember going, oh, really? And he went, yeah. And we do a 12-step program. And it's amazing. And I remember just thinking, what? Like, what are they talking about? Like, they're going to do a 12-step program and it's amazing. I remember just thinking this was mind-blowing that they were openly admitting to going to a 12-step program.
Yeah.
But there was something in your eyes and in Sadie's eye. There was some kind of, like, something was going on and I was interested because Sadie she looked completely different. You know, she was definitely beaming, you know, this, you know, as she always is now, like she's just beaming this energy out of her face. And I remember it sowed a seed. It really, really sowed a seed with me. And I really suffered a lot the next couple of years having had that conversation with you. But as we know now, with my sort of practice that I have, is that there are no coincidences. And that lightning bolt moment was you and Sadie. That was the point. Because until then, it had never even crossed my mind that I would ever go to a 12-step program or need to or want to. Or that would be the end of my life if that happened. Then it's time to just that's it. It's game over. That was how I thought in my stigma of what.
It's amazing that moments like that actually happen in life.
Yeah,
and it's pretty incredible because I didn't even realize that. You know, but
I remember what you said to me. Remember exactly what you said, and I say it as well. I nicked it, and you said, you don't drink either, and you went, oh no, I don't drink. Yeah, I can't. I went, well, not even one, and you went, no, I go on a missing list. And that's what you said to me, and I loved that, and I thought that's a good one. I'm nicking that because that was exactly how I did it. It was exactly the same. I would go, I'd literally disappear. I'd go out for a pint of milk on Thursday, come back Monday. You know, that was my style, and then I wouldn't drink for ages. Then I would.
That's exactly me. That's literally exactly me.
Yeah. So I struggled a lot with accepting that I was alcoholic or even understanding what an alcoholic was because I thought, well, how can I be an alcoholic if I don't drink for months? I can't possibly be one because I would put it down and I'm never doing that again. But then I would, you know.
Was that because I would make myself so ill after a complete bender with cocaine as well, and I would just absolutely rinse it until I couldn't go anymore or was unconscious, or I'd usually take a handful of pills just to knock me out when I was on a come down and wake up and feel so bad. I'm like, I literally would say, never doing it again. I'd go and get a fake tan. I'd start taking vitamins. I couldn't go to gym straight away because I was a mess, but I'd start doing that. And that cycle got shorter and shorter till I was about a 3-day cycle. And that's when I was really in despair in the end.
That's exactly. Well, actually, that's where I could see it going. I mean, I consider myself, at the time, I thought, I'm so unlucky. I'm in AA and I'm 32. What's the matter? This is horrendous. But I actually look back now and I think I'm so lucky that my alcoholism had such drastic consequences so immediately. Because if I was a happy drunk, I'd probably be drunk now.
Yeah.
You know, that the truth is that because my drinking was so extreme and my behavior was so extreme, it brought me to my knees quickly and I hit that rock bottom very quickly. And so I couldn't drink. It wasn't like, I look at people that might have a weed addiction or something like that. And the thing with weed, I remember someone said once, it's like being kicked to death by fluffy bunnies, you know, whereas my alcoholism True. Was like, you know, people yeah. wanted to kill me when I drank. I was everywhere. I was a large person. And as a person anyway, I'm like, I'm 3 pints in anyway as a person. So if I've had three, I've had six.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? As a person, I'd start making people like nervous, start making people uncomfortable, and people just wanted to kill me. And also I was a pretty wild character anyway. I would do insane things when I was drinking. And so I'm amazed at how long it took me to get to that point where I was like, why am I persevering with this insanity? And I think back on it and I think it wasn't agreeing with me straight away. I mean, I hospitalized myself drinking when I was 14.
Is that when you started?
That's when I started. it was almost like a sort of self-destruction. It wasn't like, let's all have a drink. It was like, I'm going to destroy myself. And that was the object of the game every time. And so now I'm older and I can look back and I've done a lot of work. I can say, well, I was probably a very wounded child that didn't really love himself very much and didn't really know, couldn't fit in, couldn't blend in, was strange, struggled to make friends and whatever.
Is that how, so you were born in Bromley in 1980, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So 11 years younger than me.
Right. Yeah.
what was the childhood like then? What kind of made you feel like that you didn't fit in? Did you have any struggles at home? Or like anything happen to make you feel like that?
Or was it just a natural? I had a very large Irish family. So my mum was one of 13 kids. She had 9 brothers and a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them were very hard drinking men. Yeah. You know, very funny, really hilarious characters. And I really wanted to be like them and I wanted to handle my drink. I really wanted to handle it. You know, I wanted to be a man and handle my drink. I wanted to be that guy that just stood there drinking pints and pints with the lads. And I remember saying to my mum when I was very young, when can I go to the pub? And I'd be like 6. And she said, you're 6. You can't go to the pub. And I'm like, I want to go to the pub. I want to go to the pub with my cousins and my mates. And I just wanted that life of having a laugh and having a, because that's what I saw, you know.
It's a big impression on a young man, isn't it? When you see all that laughs, the conviviality of it, the masculinity, and it's like, that's a crew.
Yeah.
I want to belong.
And they were safe. You know, like that was like, you know, to me, the alpha male stood there with the pint and the fag and the jokes and that was the alpha male. That's how you were king of the jungle. You had those qualities about you. And so I learned very quickly that to get attention, especially my Irish Catholic family, well, I think I've got 58 first cousins. I mean, it's insane.
That's a big firm.
It's a big, big firm. And it is a big firm as well, you know, and we're all very similar in many ways. And, you know, my mum's brothers, she's got 9 brothers, you know, and they're all, you know, really big characters. And a lot of them have passed away now. And also her sisters as well, also very, very funny characters, big, big characters. And so to get the spotlight, you had to be funny. You know, you had to have something, whether it be singing, dancing, comedy, you know, like comedy was king. You know, that's how you got your slot. If you were funny, if you weren't funny, forget about it. You were a wallflower. You stood there and you sit in the chair and you take it. You know, that was the thing. And my family, my uncles would sit me in the chair and you just had to sit there until it was done. And I learned that very early on, that if you stormed off or you didn't, you know, you had to take a joke. Because if you didn't, they just went, it just got worse. It got so much worse. So you just, you sat there and you took it and you learned to give it and you learned to take it.
That's probably given you a bulletproof vest along the line.
I think so. I think of all the things that I was given, you know, as of the sort of skill set that I've got, I'd say that the one I'm most grateful for is my robust sense of humour.
Yeah.
Because it's got me through everything in life, everything.
Humour's an amazing thing. It's a brilliant tool that I don't think Americans understand it.
I mean, when I drank, I mean, I asked to leave a lot of parties in America. They're like, dude, why would you say that? And I was like, look, it's just a laugh. I go, man, you can't say that shit. That's really offensive. Like, I'm really offended by that. Now, that would just happen to me all the time. I go, dude, get out. That has to happen all the time because of my British sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, which is gallows humor, really dark. The darker it is, the better. And that's just the way it was, you know, because we speak the same language as them, but we are very foreign.
And I think it's really intelligent. Comedy's very intelligent because you read between the lines, you guess stuff and you can fill in the gaps and whatnot. And I think my granddad was very funny and I think he was a war hero. And I think that going through the Second World War and all the stuff they had and rations and whatever, if you don't laugh, If you haven't got other things to, you know, objectify, then you just, it's humour.
You have it. You just have to have it. I mean, like, and what I find, I mean, luckily my children, the thing I'm most proud of is that they have my sense of humour. You know, they're bulletproof. And I said that to them. I said, you know what? You'll be all right because you've got that sense of humour. And I've gone through a really unpleasant divorce. I think divorces are supposed to be pleasant, but I went through a particularly nasty one. And I remember in the eye of the storm, I'd be with my girls they just got me through everything. My girls, they're amazing. And obviously they were going through it as well. And I had this moment where if I had a laugh, I was really having a belly laugh, which would be a rare occasion in the early days. My youngest, Audrey, would just lean over and go, "What are you doing?" I go, "What?" She go, "You're going through a divorce, mate." That is on that level.
Yeah.
And she just reminded me, you know, "You're going through a divorce, what are you doing?" It's just that kind of...
Come back down, Dad.
Yeah. And it was, you know, and the one thing that I'm most, you know, the wonderful thing about me and my two girls is that we have just got a great sense of humour. And the worst things get, if you have that sense of humour, the worst things get, the funnier it is.
My house is like that.
Exactly. It's the best.
I think it's funny. My so my wife's Italian, and she had very good schooling, and we have a different sense of humour, but we do punologies and stuff like that. So we just pun around the house, like joking. Now I've got the girls at it, the 6-year-olds doing puns and asking me, "Is that right?" And it's, I love it.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Yeah.
When you got hammered the first time when you was 14, was it like you felt like you'd arrived because you was now your uncles were and the family were, or was there something else going on?
There was lots going on for me personally at that time, and you don't realise it at the time. But so I lost my best friend when I was 12. He died. I don't know if it was suicide. They said it wasn't, but he died on a dog lead, and it was very, very traumatic. And I realise now that at that school, the school that I went to was an all-boys school in Bromley. And I actually got suspended from that school because my behaviour was quite bad. I was getting in a lot of punch-ups. It was a very rough school, actually. It was a very tough school. And I wasn't dealing very well with the death of my best friend, I don't think. And it was really hard. I was also on television. I was in Grange Hill when I was like 12.
He was like 12, no? Yeah.
So, and that was a massive amount of exposure for me. I mean, I'd been an actor. I started as a dancer when I was like 8. I was on stage with Ronnie Corbett and Lionel Blair tap dancing.
Did
when
you
I was
really?
Eight.
I didn't know that. No way.
Yeah, I don't, that's not something, because it wasn't, I suppose that was my first professional job, you know, was at that age. So I've been acting and performing for a long time.
But did you train in school or did you go outside of school?
Outside of school. So it was a club, really, that my mum encouraged us to do it because it was it would help us. My mum's big on her English, so she loves English, and she said if you study drama, it will help you with your English because it's Shakespeare and poetry and prose. And she was absolutely right. You know, I love English, and it did help me with my English, but it also gave me the bug for performance. Yeah. And to this rabid addict, you know, that was something that I just wanted more and more and more.
It's an incredible buzz, isn't it? I mean, I've only done like 5 movies and stuff, but in modeling, doing fashion shows, there is a buzz
that you can
taste in the air and know it. You know, I think for any performer, there's an attention that you get. It's an energetic thing as well as a physical thing. For even if it's a makeup artist, hair, producer, sound guy, whatever, it's all about you at that moment.
Mm.
I know it's not about you, but for someone like me, it's about me. Mm. And there's this energy that after jobs, especially if it was a big job or a long job, I would just feel so flat.
Mm.
And heavy.
Yeah.
And think shit. And I'd phone people and say, "Oh yeah, no, things are bad." And they must have thought, "Oh, stop whining, dude. You're like really doing very well."
Yeah. It's a major roller coaster, that.
Yeah.
I mean, I just finished a play at Stratford East, Abigail's Party with Tamsin Althwaite. And we weren't expecting it to be the success that it was. We just, you know, and we knew it's a brilliant play, obviously, but we weren't expecting it to be like just knockout play. And every night, you know, everybody was stood in the audience. And Tamsin and I talked to each other a lot following when the play came to an end, and we were thinking this is gonna transfer, and everyone was going, "This is gonna transfer," and it hasn't yet. And Tamsin would be phoning me going, "I am just so dead. I feel so depressed. And it's true. It's a major, major hit that. Yeah. And you'd come off stage and everyone would be standing there. And also, that's another thing. When I was doing a play and I was drinking, it was biblical. I would go out and I would drink to all hours just to come down from what we'd experienced. You know, it was such a hit. There's nothing really like that.
It's hard to explain to people, isn't it?
Very hard to explain to people. I'll come home. I mean, I do it now. I'm going to come home and sober. I'm looking at the ceiling and I'm just, it's 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and I can't get to sleep, you know? So it is a real chemical hit. And obviously what goes up must come down. And when I finish a play or a film, or if you've got a lovely crew and they're all, you miss that routine. And then suddenly we just get sat and no one understands that about actors or performers, is that when we're on, it's intensive. Yeah. You know, like we work intensively, but we also don't work intensively, and that's really, really hard to work around.
The bits in between.
Yeah,
that's amazing. So, how was that for the pressure for the first time? Because that was a big show as well, wasn't it?
Mm. So, Grange Hill was my first television gig and a massive one, and also fame as well. So I remember I was in Paris with my mum and dad and my brothers and sisters. I'm the eldest of 5 kids, and I remember I was in Paris with the family in Montmartre, and I got mobbed in Montmartre, and I was like 13, and it was the first time that I've been recognised as a famous actor or whatever. And I got mobbed by all these kids who were on a school trip, all from the Scousers, actually, from Liverpool.
Excellent. Amongst all the artists trying to join the joints.
Like, there he is. Look, there's Sam from Greenville over there, look like. And can I have a photograph with you? Actually, but they didn't have photographs. It was just like, they had little snap cameras and it was all autographs.
Sign my little bit, sign my little pad.
And sign my little bullshit. And and that was the first time I'd experienced it. And then that was it. And then I had kids coming up to the door, to the house. And I was a very normal kid. I went to a normal school. And then, you know, I had jealousy at school, you know, from other kids. At the all-boys school, it wasn't as bad. But my mum removed me from that school and put me in a mixed school in Chislehurst in South London. And that's when things really, really just were out of control. I mean, like, because there were girls there and I was on the television. Yeah. So the girls wanted to go out with the guy who's on television. And so the hatred I had from the bullies in the school was just off the scale. And I had kids from other schools and other blazers waiting for me outside the school gates. And the bullies in my school were going, "He's going around the back. Don't worry, he's going around the back. You'll get him around there." And so it was relentless. And the teachers were jealous as well. So I remember one teacher saw me getting a pasting by a few lads from another school, and he was there to stop it. He was monitoring
slowly.
And he just turned his back.
No,
and just let me get a kick in. I'll never forget that.
The teachers were worse. It's so weird, isn't it? It's so weird, this jealousy thing, if you're a performer. I think that's interesting that people don't realise that when you're successful in one of these fields where you're on someone's telly or you're in the media, that there's a whole painful side of it. Not to put it all down, but there is a side that people look at and think, "Oh, he's famous. He's all right. He's getting money. He's in the thing. There's nothing wrong." But there's a dark side to it.
There is. I mean, I think that with comedy as well, like, with anyone I know who's funny, if you scratch the surface, there's tragedy there somewhere, because you have to, it's a trauma response. I don't know, you know, I mean, what isn't a trauma response these days? But I mean, I feel that for me, it was, I can't do sincerity all the time. I can do it. If you tell me that your nan's passed away, I can be sincere in that moment.
Yeah.
But if you tell me that your hamster's died, I might struggle with that. So, you
know, depending where it died.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, where did it die? You know, it was a gerbil. But but I just think it's like we all deal with things differently. And I think that, you know, that's why comedy is so important, because it is a way that we process things. You know, I remember a friend of mine was asked to leave court because he was laughing so much in the dock. That the judge said, "Get out. This is a really serious case." And it was the nerves that were making him laugh. So, you know, I just feel like, you know, especially if we're British as well, like, comedy is something that you develop from a young age. It's usually come from, it's a moment where you go, "I can't cope with this. I'm going to be funny." Yeah. And also what I discovered, because I wasn't a big bloke and I wasn't a hard bloke. So for me, being funny was a way out of bullying. So I knew that if I could make them laugh, then they'd warm to me. And they did, you know, it did really work.
How was your drinking after the first time you had a drink?
So my dad has never drank, you know, and it is insane, honestly. My dad is a health and safety inspector. And
no
he, honest to God, you would never believe that I came out of my dad's testicles. But other than the fact that we look exactly the same. And my dad was just the best dad growing up. He was just a very reliable man. He turned up on time every night at 6 o'clock on the dot. He was home, never had boozy mates, never was off, you know, philandering, or it just was the most solid, decent dad you could have ever asked for. But he did not drink. And, you know, I look back now and I remember thinking, God, dad's so boring. But I look back now as a dad myself and I think, wow, what a duty to just do what he did. It was amazing.
Legendary, actually.
It really, really, really legendary. I mean, if he had gone out and got drunk, my mum would have castrated him. So there was that helped. My mum, you know, very different character. All the comedy comes from her side of the family and her own stuff, you know. But my dad was like, I remember I'd take him, we'd go to the pub on Christmas Day as a tradition, and I'd be on my third pint of Guinness. God, I'd get onto the third one pretty quick, and my dad would still be nursing he hadn't even made it down to the Guinness sign, you know.
Fine,
and
we're still on top.
I'd be like, "Come on, Dad, it's going on." He'd be actually falling asleep in his pint. So he was just very, very happy with who he was as a person, and never felt like he needed to change himself, you know. Whereas, and my mum never drank it either, actually, but that was unusual in her family. It's only her and maybe one or two others of her siblings that aren't really, you know, don't really enjoy a drink. But, you know, the rest of them love it. And we would go to Ireland as well for our holidays, and they'd have to lock the pub because there were so many of us that they'd lock it. And I just remember being a kid and just trying to breathe out of the crack in the door where it's smoky in there, just
inhaling the lot.
17 packets of Tato crisps and, you know, red lemonades. It was like, I remember just thinking, get me out of this. Oh, this is awful. You know, but that's what they did. And then the songs would come out. Whenever I hear people Irish singing, I think, oh, someone's going to get chinned in a minute. You know, it triggers me.
I did a big campaign in Ireland years ago, and we arrived from New York really late. Didn't get to this. We were staying in a B&B in a pub. Because we were in the middle of nowhere and I was starving. I'm like, do you have any sandwiches? No. Do you have like any snacks? No. She said, what I suggest is you have a couple of Guinnesses, and it's like a whole meal in itself. And I was like, I don't really want to drink because, you know, I'm trying to behave. Meanwhile, we was on this plane. I won't mention who it was, but it was a big campaign. The guy I was with, we had the top floor. It was Alitalia, weirdly. They used to have these big green seats upstairs and we had the whole upstairs to ourselves. So we started just having a couple of drinks. And then all I remember, we was climbing on the seats, trying to see how far we could jump on the seats. And then I woke up in the toilet with a burn mark on my head, like crammed sideways like that. And I can't remember what happened, but the blue stuff that was in the toilet had burnt like a whole mark in the side of my head. I was like, oh my God, we're shooting tomorrow, this campaign.
I mean, I remember, so as a child actor in the early 90s, I mean, this is the thing. I reckon I've noticed how professional the industry is now compared to what it was then, you know, and it was perfectly acceptable for you to get absolutely bladdered the night before filming. And I'd be like 15 and I would be completely bladdered up till 3 or 4 a.m. with the other actors.
Yeah.
And the producer would be like, good night, everyone. And let's see you. I mean, can you imagine now? He's got a 15-year-old, 4 a.m. He's been picked up at 7. And they'd be like, oh, Kevin, you know, maybe go to bed fairly soon. But they'd be horrified now, you know, and they'd have a chaperone as well. You know,
they'd be like lawsuits flying and bits of paper everywhere.
And that's what everyone said to me. They'd say, oh, were you a child actor? Were you molested then? You know, you must have been like, nobody laid a finger on me. Like literally nobody laid a finger on me. And I don't know why, because I saw everything and I put myself in some serious situations, but not even, it's a shame actually, because, you know, I was very attractive. it's really not my confidence.
Could have a few cheap nights.
Yeah, I mean, come on. I was an 11, you know. But it was a wonderful business, and there were some great characters in it. And I miss those characters. You don't really see them coming through anymore. Those hard drinking, big character, big stories, anecdotal actors. It's too professional now. It's like football. I remember, I mean, one of my favourite memories. I was on Casualty as well for like as a semi regular. I was Sorica Cusack's son, and so I kept going up and down all the time. And I remember I was just like, I was so hungover, I wanted to die every time we filmed. And I didn't realise, obviously, at the time, I was an alcoholic. I just didn't know that. I just thought, I'm just a young guy. You know, he was, you know, a bit too much fun. I was a full-blown alcoholic. And then I would go home to my normal life and be normal again. And then back into the... And I associated work with oh, now it's time to party. We're in a hotel. I didn't see it as a professional thing. It was like, oh, got a job. So that means drinking every day for the job. That was the mentality. This is the 90s, you know?
And how did you remember your lines?
Well, that was one thing. If you're a child actor, that's the one thing that's just drilled in, isn't it? From a young age, you know, everyone always asks me that. Everyone always says, how'd you learn lines? And and that's the easiest part of it for me.
But to retain them, like if you've got a hangover or it's just you had them
I wasn't obviously on my best form. I was seriously underperforming, but you know, that's how it was. Everybody, and it's not that I was the only one, like everybody was doing what I was doing. And if you... I mean, nobody ever said, I don't drink. Like, that was insane. People would be like, what do you mean, don't drink? I mean, don't drink. You're an actor. Like, and I think that the reason I became an actor, this is the ultimate addicty thing to do, was because I wanted to be a celebrated pisshead like Oliver Reed or Richard Harris or Peter O'Toole. That they were my idols. You know, that's who I wanted to be. When I saw them on television and I saw George Best, I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to drink and get paid for it. And everyone go, he's great and he's funny and he's lovely. That's what I want to do. Because in those days, those people were demigods, weren't they?
Yeah.
And now you'd go, oh, he's a terrible alcoholic. You know, but it's totally
it's
changed.
It's funny. So it was probably like, what, because it's having the admiration, isn't it? And the prestige. So I realize now that I just wanted to have the prestige, whatever it was. That's literally all I wanted to do was have the prestige. I thought at the time it's the career, the travel and stuff. But if I'm really honest,
just wait that.
I wanted to be applauded. And I think that comes from having such low self-esteem as a kid. Don't know where it came from. Can't tell you why. I was really good athlete, good boxer, shit footballer, but still played, had some trophies. But I just had this real, like a hole, I just used to sit there thinking, how are these guys having this conversation? I don't even know people talk. Like, I just don't know how they retain stuff, which is quite remarkable. You retained lines when you was earlier, because I couldn't even remember like lyrics from a song. And I feel that because I had some trauma early on in my life, I feel like I disassociated. So I would just be thinking, fantasizing, because I was uncomfortable. And that was probably my first addiction, not even knowing. So for me, I feel like coming into recovery and putting down drinking drugs was just the start, just the beginning. And it was really for me about waking up, because I suffered from terrible anxiety. I mean, I was literally, I don't know how I survived, basically. I just used to wing things and just turn up and think, oh, I got away with that.
Yeah.
It was quite sad, actually.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful now, being in recovery, that I thought it was just about putting down the drink and stuff. But you get to really learn about yourself. And for me, I'm really grateful that I'm present now, especially as a dad.
Yeah.
To be present with the kids is unbelievable.
I think as a dad, I think the best gift that you can give your kids, whether they're boy, girl, teenager, whatever, or whenever you get into it, you know, the best gift you can give your child is you be sober, as a sober dad. There isn't anything better, I don't think, you can give. And I know that because my dad did it, you know, and I look at my dad and I think, yeah, he might not have been taking me to football every weekend and it being exhilarating, or, you know, taking me to the pub when I was 15, 16. But, you know, he gave me the space because he was a very, very mild and humble man. And he gave me the space to grow into the man that I am. You know, he didn't knock that out of me. You know, he was a good dad is a good dad. And so I see that now. You know, I'm much more grateful for that, and I sort of regret in many ways that I didn't see that about him in the early years, because I just wanted to be with the winners. You know, I've always been very impressionable my whole life, and it's been good for me and bad. And I think that, you know, it got me in trouble when I was younger, because I got me in bad crowds and whatever, because they looked like they were the alpha males. You know, they were the kings of the jungle, so I wanted to be with them. But now I look at it in terms of recovery, I also stick with the winners in that.
Yeah.
You know, my being impressionable in recovery was really good for me, because I looked at people who had got a hold of their life, and that's what I wanted. When I looked at those people that were sober, but they were smashing life, they had their businesses sorted out, they were loving life, they were doing things, they weren't just sitting there unemployed and you know,
being legends by a bar or whatever.
Yeah, and then turning up to the midday meeting and, you know, having a cup of tea and some biscuits and then sitting there and moaning. Like, the ones that were cracking on, I was like, yeah, I'll have a bit of that, because I'm impressionable. So it gave me a good recovery.
Yeah, you know? It's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah,
so.
definitely.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, I don't know if it's a boy thing, but I had that when I was younger. Just whoever had the biggest car, biggest watch, loudest person, whoever had the boat, whatever, that was who I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I look back at my dad, and he comes from a big family in the East End, and I just think sometimes, I used to be, why are you not fucking doing that? Why are you not doing this? Why are you not doing that? Mm. And actually, in hindsight, I look at my dad. Did you ever see a movie, The Bronx Tale?
Yeah.
He wasn't a bus driver, but he reminded me of De Niro in there, that was close to that environment, knew all that environment, all his friends was around that environment.
But knew it was wrong,
and knew it was wrong for him. Mm. So he really, in hindsight, he showed up and was actually pretty smart, always looked after us, told me the right things, told me how to look after myself. He was very tough, very disciplined, which I resented for a long time.
Yeah.
And did the little violin. Oh, my dad was really... But actually, he taught me a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful for that today.
Yeah. I don't know what that is. I don't know if it's as we get older, we either become more like our parents or we realise what they were trying to do. And something that when you'll understand this, and not everybody does, but like if you have worked a 12-step program like I have, and I've done my steps now 3 times. So I've gone through it in depth with fantastic.
Same sponsor?
Yeah, two sponsors, because I relapsed after 5 years. So I was sober for 5 years, and my first sponsor, who was incredible, and I'll always remember the things that he said to me. I mean, he actually said he put forgiveness into such an amazing place for me, because I never ever thought I'd ever forgive anyone for anything, and I was quite proud about that.
Yeah.
I'll never forgive anyone for anything. People go, you should forgive them. I used to think, fuck off, forgiving anyone. I really thought that was a powerful thing in me. You know, they go, but he's done that, and they go, yeah, but don't you miss him? And I go, yeah, but he's done that. You know, I just couldn't get my head around it. And I remember my amazing sponsor in his beautiful flat in Brighton. He was a hairdresser, and he would cut my hair as well. He would talk to me, and he would say, the thing is, Kev, he said, me and you can have a row. We fall out. Let's just say we fall out today. And I'm right, though, and you were out of order. He said, and I see you down there walking your dog, and I look out the window and I go, yeah, I was right. Yeah. But I miss my mate. And I don't see him anymore. Just because I'm right, I don't see him anymore.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't ever laugh at my mate. And I don't cut his hair. And he makes me barely laugh anymore, because I was right. And he was wrong. And he deserves it. And when he said it, it suddenly made me realise all those lovely things that we learn in AA is just like, letting go is everything. It's just everything. And I didn't realise that. I thought holding on and controlling everything and being in charge and telling everyone what to do, that's it. That had got me where I was. It got me really far. And then to suddenly go, now I'm this person who goes, hey, it doesn't feel right, let it go. Don't see my stream. I'm like, what am I saying?
Yeah.
But that is really what it is. And I think that the lovely thing about being in recovery is there's an awful lot of spiritual bollocks going on at the moment. And I see that everywhere. And I don't know if it's Instagram or whatever, TikTok or everything. There's a lot of people who are really, really spiritual, but it's bollocks. Yeah. You know, what it's really about is about you admitting that you are wrong. And you might not have been wrong for the whole thing, but there was a bit that you did. There was a little bit, no matter how small, you did a little bit. And once you own that, it's powerful stuff.
It's powerful. It's hard to, I was always taught to, if you're powerful, you feel strong. If you're resentful, which means you feel like you have the upper hand because you're letting them go, or you're pushing them away, and you're cutting people off. And I'm really good at doing that. I'm like, nope, done. Because I couldn't handle the situation. But
I would sort of emotionally ghost someone, because I didn't have the ability to say, this is what's happened.
It's easy to say no. Mm. The conversation. Someone said to me, do you want to be right or do you want to be free? And I was like, free? What do you mean free? He said, because you resenting someone, when you're in the shower, when you're in bed, when you're in your car, you're thinking of them. Mm. Are they paying rent? I was like, no. Mm. So why are you holding them in your thoughts? Mm. And it really struck me, like, fucking hell, actually, you know what? It's quite painful for me.
Yeah.
It's like being a prison guard, maybe in porridge, but it's like being a prison guard outside the door.
Yeah.
Right? But you're still there in the same place.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never understood that before.
But it's just, I remember something when I was going through a personal thing a long time ago, and one of my very good friends in AA, who came in at the same time before I relapsed, or that relapse, as I call it, the decider.
Why was there a decider?
So I was so happy, you know, in my sobriety. I was I actually struggle to get back to that place, you know, where I was, where I was so powerful, I was so free, you know, and I was decided. I was like, this is it. This is my life now. I love this.
And was that in England?
Yeah, that was in England. So I'd come back from, I disgraced myself in Australia at a press junket that I was supposed to be. I was supposed to be the funny guy in the group of lads, and we'd got on the tear, all of us, for 3 days, you know, and I was a day longer than the others, and we got to the press junket, and I couldn't even speak; I was mute, and they gave me an Australian decongestion, which had traces of speed in it, and it spun me out into a panic attack, and I thought I was going to have a heart attack and die in the radio station in Sydney.
So that went well.
That went really well. And I remember lying there on the floor, and all I could think of was my wife already hated me anyway at the time. I was thinking, she's got to come and identify a corpse. I was thinking, fucking hell, she hates me as it is. She's going to hate me posthumously as well. This is a disaster. And so that was my last drink. And I remember I got to Los Angeles and I went to my first AA meeting in Los Angeles in Venice, and I was the only person there who wasn't homeless. And I remember coming out and going, yes, I'm not an alcoholic. They are, because they're all homeless. That's what, I just fucking got calmed down a bit, you know. And then, but I knew that something wasn't right about the way I drank. I knew I had the phenomenon of craving, and I did not process it the same way as everyone else. And when I drank, bad things happened to me and I couldn't stop.
Yeah.
Until I was good and drunk or passed out or whatever. And so I phoned Sadie and I said, I want to know more about this. And I need to sort this out and I'm serious. And I got back to Brighton and got sober in Brighton properly with all my wonderful sober pals down there. It's a wonderful recovery down there in Brighton. And I went every single morning in the middle of the day, in the evening, like sometimes 3 meetings a day. And I worked out what recovery I wanted and what I didn't, yeah, you know. And the morning ones were for me, the early mornings, 7:30. I loved those ones. And someone said in the meeting, they said, the early mornings are for the desperate and the dedicated. And I thought, yep, I'll have that. That's for
it's
me.
Good.
And so I kept on going to those. And I loved my life. But what went wrong, to answer your question, was that I'd given my wife a very hard time in my drinking. You know, she loved the drink. She loved the party. But she didn't do what I used to do. And so I, you know, if you come out drinking with me, you need to bring a passport. Mm. You know, that was the way I did things. And so I, you know, she didn't really want me to stop completely. You know, she just wanted me to stop doing what I was doing. But, you know, don't stop completely.
Just the damaging part. But...
And I remember when I stopped and, do you know what? I travelled home from a wedding or whatever with my wife, basically with a drunk, and it was quite unpleasant actually when she was drunk. Could be. And I remember thinking, doesn't matter what I put her through. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I was so robust. It didn't bother me at all. I was bulletproof. And I thought, I deserve it. It's fine. And I had no problem at all. But of all the people I thought would encourage me to drink again, I didn't think it would be her. I had two beautiful kids, and she said to me, I think she just missed her drinking buddy. And I thought, well, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the boring guy. I'm supposed to save my marriage, not end my marriage. What's going on? And she turned around to me and she was saying, I just don't know if I preferred you drinking or sober. That's what she said to me.
It's quite tough
and
to hear.
And it spun me out completely. And I remember I talked to my sponsor about this, and he said to me, Kevin, whatever we put in front of our sobriety will get taken away from us anyway.
Mm.
And at the time, I remember thinking, whatever, you don't know my marriage, you don't know what I'm going through, I've been with this person all my life and you don't realize. And he was right, because I drank, and within 21 months I was living in an Airbnb with my dog in a flat, and it was over, you know. And so he was right in many ways, but I still believe that this happens a lot in sobriety. When people get sober, this is a different person now. I'm a different person. The toxic guy that she fell in love with isn't there anymore. He's gone. He's still a bit toxic, especially in his sense of humour.
Only sometimes.
But he doesn't disappear, and he isn't a liar, and he isn't, do you know what I mean? He's still a different guy. My circuit board is completely new. And so it's hard for the partner, because they're like, who's this guy? Who's that? Where's that guy that, I hated him, but, you know, we had a balance, you know, but who's this guy? You know, this new bloke. So, and I hear that a lot in the rooms. You know, I hear about marriages failing when people get sober. But if your marriage fails when you get sober, it's meant to.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I think. And I'm so glad that I've gone through what I've gone through and that I've processed my, you know, and actually my divorce, which has only just gone through, I didn't pick up a drink. Yeah. And I'm now 6 years sober. And I'm so, so grateful. I don't know how I'd managed to get through it, but I did not pick up a drink. And had I picked up a drink and drank through the sadness of a divorce, the process that everyone does, if I'd have been that guy who was in the Wetherspoons and, you know,
postponing the pain.
Exactly. Then I really, really would. I really think I would be, I might not bounce back from that, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm glad that I did everything on, you know, life's terms as opposed to drinking through it.
That must have been quite a painful time, though. Because if you learned that much about yourself, I think the thing for me was when I saw meetings on TV, I remember like Meatloaf and Fight Club and other things, I just thought, what are those people doing? That's so not me. You don't know who I am. Mm. Still thinking I want to be a legend and having fun. And I never knew. I thought it'd be boring. You know, and sometimes I say this, sometimes I can cut my lawn and sort of look over at my neighbour and just think, I have no idea. Like, no idea at all. But I like that because I feel like people say to me, don't you miss drinking? Don't you miss that? And I'm like, no, I don't. No. I don't at all. And they say, oh, you're boring. And I'm like, no, actually, when you think about it, if you have to have a drink, you're boring because you can't have a laugh as you are.
Yeah.
You can't enjoy life as you are. Yeah, there is, right?
But it's true what you say. Like, I mean, look, I also had this moment where I thought life is boring. Life is about paying bills. And I'm not one of these people who's going to sit here and go, do you know what? Well, I'm so happy. Like, it was terrible when I drank. It was miserable. Yeah, it was, but it was amazing as well. I mean, I did extreme things, but they are the best things. And I'm so glad I did it and I don't. And I can sit here now and talk very candidly about the terrible things that I've done. I'm very open. I don't really hold much back because I feel like that's part of who I am.
Yeah.
But I can tell you also that I'm glad that I experienced it and I'm glad that I can talk about it and laugh about it now because I'm sober. Whereas at the time, I never told you what I did. I never told you that thing that happened. I never told you when I woke up with one shoe on and I was on that bus and I don't know how I got there. And you know, I never talked about that at the time. I was in deep, deep shame about the life that I was living. And I didn't want anyone to know what a dirty scumbag I was and what I was getting up to, you know. But now I can sit there and we can belly laugh about it because it's not happening anymore. It's funny because it doesn't happen anymore. I used to think I had a sixth sense, right? So I'd go out the door and I'd go, something I've got a bad feeling about tonight. We can't go out. So I'm telling you, I've got a bad feeling. My wife go, we're talking about, what's the matter with you? You're always saying this. I go, no, I can't. I've got a bad feeling. I'm telling you, something bad's going to happen. And something bad would happen. It would be biblical. It'd be terrible. And I'd say, see, I told you. I had a sixth sense. And it's funny. Now I don't drink. I don't know. My sixth sense has gone on back to five. Because the truth is that I know I'm coming home at half 10. You know, what it was I was in denial. I knew I was out of control.
Yeah.
And I did not know as soon as I put that drink in my body where I was going to go. It was roulette every time I did it. And sometimes were brilliant, but every now and then there was a bullet in the chamber and it would blow my brains out. And I just got sick of my odds. Like you said, like the cycles were getting, every time it was like musical chairs, someone had put another bullet in the chamber every time I got away with it. And then it's, you know, every time, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I love my new life. It's the best, you know, it really is. And like, the one thing about this program is it is not easy. But it is simple. It isn't easy, but it's so simple. And I talk to people and they go, yeah, but they're trying to intellectualize the whole thing. I'm like, you might be right, but just don't drink today and see how you get on.
It's not an intellectual program, is it?
No.
How are you with creativity? Because I must say, when I first come in, I have some, like you, some brilliant stories, and I am so glad that I've experienced all that stuff in my life, genuinely.
Amazing.
There's a few, maybe not, but but I'm so glad I am today. And sometimes I do feel a little bit fidgety, like something's got to go on. But how are you with creativity? Because when I first come in, I didn't actually work for like a year and a half, and I went to a little acting school around the corner, and fortunately my acting teacher was sober at the time, and I didn't know, and I did some really bad performance. Trying to be an alcoholic, he's like, that's not how you do it. I was like, I'm telling you, I know how it is. He's like, no, I'm telling you, I know how it is. And he said, I'm 13 years sober. And he took me under his wing, which was amazing. But I didn't want to go back into fashion for quite some time because I was so terrified that I had no sort of willpower, whatever it was, to, you know, get involved. But I found after, I thought my career was over. So I was 33, right? So I didn't start modeling until 35, which usually is over. And I had a better career after. And I really smashed it out of the ballpark in the 90s. So I thought it was impossible. And I kind of went back cap in hand, did a couple. I think my first job, I went from doing massive campaigns for Versace and shoots with Bruce Weber and lots of money to doing Matalan for a couple of grand. Very humbling with Jeff Banks. Went back, did my first shoot. And I really needed that because it was humbling, but I was like, I'm grateful that I'm working again. I'm actually, the set looks different. It feels different. It's not all about me. It's like about the product and about the people. And I walked away from that job feeling really grateful, where I'd before had a lot of money and was like, oh, where's the next one? What's going on? But creatively, I became on fire again, and it was like a different thing though. Got that spark back, got the life back, and actually did really well. How's creativity for you?
Well, that's a question actually that we talk about a lot, you know, not just in acting circles or writings, because I write as well and produce as well, but like, you know, we talk about this in general with art and all sorts of things. And I think that, you know, pain does give us that creative spark. I mean, I a little while ago, I stumbled across some like poetry I was writing when I was drinking, and it's good, but it's like, you know, very self-indulgent and very victim. But I get these bursts of focus and drive. Obviously, when I'm ADHD as well, and you know, undiagnosed like everybody, but I've definitely got it. And I have that hyper focus through pain and through desperation. And I remember in the old days, I would sit and write a script in 2 weeks, a film script, and would not leave the room, you know. And now I'm older and I'm sober, that doesn't happen. But the ideas are still there. They're still there. They're not as frequent as they were when I was maybe I had the Kevin Bishop show, in where I used to write 350 sketches a series. I don't even know where I'd start with that.
That's
now.
Insane.
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know even where I would even begin to do that. I don't even know how I did it then, because I was really at it in those days, you know, like I barely slept and I was still doing that amount of work. But I think those jobs suited me. So I was a chef, I was an actor, you know, anything that was high intensity, that was perfect for me. Yeah. So really high intensity. So chefing was great. And also for my ADHD, I need fear to focus. So if I'm doing a play, I need to be terrified in order to remember my lines and to remember where I'm stood and to be on the thing. And I hate it if I do a play and I'm like, I don't feel nervous. I feel really confident. I hate it.
Absolutely the opposite.
No, I need that to focus. Really? Or I can't focus.
You need to teach me that one.
Well, I think it's an ADHD thing. I think that's what it is. And it's funny, a lot of DJs are like it and a lot of performers are like that we've chosen those high-octane careers.
I think it's the word fear, though, because for me, fear was like to pull away from something. Mm. But I had that adrenaline and my mind would be sharp and stuff. But with certain things, I had fear.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Like with fashion, I had no fear, shows, like commercials, nothing like that.
Yeah.
But with acting, I really had fear. I used to dream as a kid that I was going to be an actor and I'd forget my lines on stage. Yeah. And I think somewhere I'd implanted that about the lines.
Yeah.
And I remember doing the first scene. I did a film called DD Hollywood with Elsa Pataky and Peter Coyote. And there's a big scene in the cafe, it's like 200 people. And I remember when he said action slowly and I was like, where's the line? Where's the word? And it felt like a tumbleweed went past and then a car drove past and something else happened. Everyone had dinner and went home. And then it come out and I was all right. But that was my biggest fear. I was like, shit, honestly.
We all have those moments. I mean, I remember I was doing a play in the West End called Pete and Dud Come Again. And I was playing Dudley Moore, who luckily was an alcoholic. So I could really good method. It was method. And I'd pulled an all-nighter and I got into this theatre. And I remember we had this Wogan-esque sort of 80s chat show room. And the show was around this interview, and I remember I just fell asleep and in the middle of the interview, and I woke up and I suddenly looked at the audience and I thought, so I'm on a stage and there's an audience there, and I don't know how.
Wow.
But I just came in with my line.
That's amazing.
Insane. I mean, you know, but the problem is for me was that I could do it. Yeah. And that was a problem. So, you know, a normal person would go, I went out all night. I disgraced myself at work. Everybody knew. I'm full of shame and I'm never doing that again. But with me, I got away with it. No one, a lot of time, no one knew.
I did that for years as well. Mm. Turn up like an hour. I'd go out, shower and set and then go straight to work.
Yeah.
But I didn't have any lines. So it was pretty easy. Mate, I think we're going to, I could speak for hours with you. I've got so much to ask and talk about.
Yeah.
But just for advice, if someone's listening, hopefully they are, and they're struggling, they're thinking about recovery or they're not sure on the edge or if they have someone in their family that's got a drink or drug problem, what would you advise them to do?
Well, for the addict themselves, I would just say, you know, the power is in the surrender, you know, ultimately. That's what it's all about. And that's where the real joy is, you know. It was when I actually said, my name's Kevin and I'm an alcoholic. I'm not perfect. I've got something wrong with me. And I held my hand up and said that in a room full of people that understood me. It all stopped. And I don't have a drink problem anymore. I still have a think problem, but I don't have a drink problem. And for the family of the alcoholic, good luck, because it comes from within. There's not really anything you can do. There's nothing you can say, but you really, really do need to be firm. And you need to sort of protect yourself from that person who's in it, they're at it, and they're going to finish when they're ready. You know, that's all I can say. Go to Al-Anon. That's all I can say. And learn how to deal with it.
Amazing words. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers, mate.
Whoa,
thanks.
That was amazing.
Loved it.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.